Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, April 2nd. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Richardson Grove Highway Project gets green light after Appellate Court sides with Caltrans. Local violinist performing for world premiere of Shades and Shadows in San Francisco. EPD seeking information on burglary earlier this week, along with analysis of Trump's primetime address and firing of Attorney General Pam Bondi. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
A verdict made by California's First District Appeals Court ended an over decade-long legal battle over Caltrans' Richardson Grove Improvement Plan. Nat Cardos reports.
After a 15-year-long legal battle, the Richardson Grove Operational Improvement Project has been greenlit after a decision handed down by the California First District Appeals Court, which ruled in favor of Caltrans on March 26. The Richardson Grove Highway Project was proposed by Caltrans in 2007 to an expanded approximately 1 mile stretch of Highway 101 in Richardson Grove State Park. The modification will allow Standard Freight Surface Transportation Assistance Act, STAA, legal vehicles to pass through the corridor, as it is currently the last non-STAA accessible portion of Highway 101. There are STAA limitations on other portions, however. To expand on portions of the road, Caltrans plans to remove 38 trees with diameters of over 4 inches, none of which are old-growth redwoods. However, they will have to dig into the roots of old growth to work on the project. Conservation groups such as the Environmental Protection Information Center, EPIC, have pointed out over the years that this could cause damage to the ancient trees and potentially destabilize them, as redwood's root systems are shallow, yet expand outward, forming large root networks within forests. Over the years, Caltrans has insisted that they would use unconventional construction methods to minimize damages, stating in a press release from yesterday, quote, "To further protect the sensitive environment of the park, Caltrans plans to use unconventional construction methods, including hand digging and air spades, to minimize impacts on redwood root systems," end quote. Conservationists argue that Caltrans is downplaying the effects of this road project. The original suit argued that the Environmental Impact Report, EIR, published in 2010, did not properly analyze the risks involved with cutting into old-growth roots. In 2012, a federal judge agreed with the project opponents and ordered Caltrans to redo major aspects of the report. KMUD News spoke with Tom Wheeler, executive director of EPIC, for more about the potential effects that the project could have on old-growth redwoods.
Redwoods have a shallow root system, and this root system is necessary for their stability. If you think about a tree that is hundreds of feet in height, it's going to catch a lot of wind. And so this interlocking root system in an old-growth redwood forest enables these trees to stay large and standing. Old-growth redwoods do not die of disease. They die from falling over. And so there are a number of trees that already have a lean within the state park, including the famous bat tree that has it's a roosting site for Yuma bats, that have a significant lean and whose root system they are going to cut into. Cutting into these structural roots is likely to reduce the lifespan of these trees. And so we are predicting two different impacts from this project. One is canopy die-off or die-back. So I think that listeners are probably familiar with trees like in Humboldt Redwood State Park, where you can look up and the top of the tree is dead wood. And there might be green foliage a little bit further down. That's because the root system of those trees were impacted from highway construction, and it impacted the ability to for the tree to service with nutrients all parts of the tree, the highest part of the tree being the most difficult to service. So we're likely to see dieback of canopy foliage, and also we're likely to see, because of the loss of structural roots, a greater tendency for trees to fall over, shortening the lifespan of these ancient trees.
In 2017 and 2023, Caltrans redid sections criticized of its EIR and prepared addenda and recertification. In 2019, it was ruled by Humboldt County Superior Court Judge Kelly Neal that Caltrans hadn't recirculated the revised EIR for public comment, therefore not following proper procedure. After it was circulated, the court discharged previous rulings and gave Caltrans the green light to proceed with the project. However, EPIC, the Center for Biological Diversity, Californians for Alternatives to Toxics, and many others appealed once more, stating that the EIR was still lacking. In the most recent ruling on March 26, the court concluded that this issue was already resolved by the trial court and that their ruling was final and unappealable.
The project was first proposed in 2007. Those were our first opportunities for public comment. The project was first approved in 2010. And then it began a long history of litigation. And fundamentally, at the heart of all this litigation are concerns that Caltrans has not adequately documented the likely environmental impacts from the project. So to be frank, there's almost too many cases to kind of recite in detail. But generally, what had occurred was that courts had found that Caltrans's analysis was faulty and that they had procedural violations in approving the project. And so for 16 years, the project had been held up by court decisions finding that the analysis was faulty, that the process by which Caltrans was pushing forward the project was rushed and had cut out public inclusion. So now we've unfortunately probably reached the end of litigation. And in the most recent decision, the court found that that the claims brought by EPIC and our allies were barred by a doctrine called res judicata, which effectively means that a court had already heard and dismissed the claims. And we fundamentally disagree with the court here. I don't believe that lower courts had ever heard the claims that we had brought, in part because there was new evidence that was introduced into the record such that it was impossible for courts to have heard the claims that we filed. So I think that this is an unfortunate way for this litigation to end on what is perhaps kind of a technicality. And unfortunately, also, Caltrans has still never admitted the likely environmental impacts from this project. So it is a huge disappointment for us here at EPIC.
During this litigation odyssey, conservationists repeatedly argued that Caltrans was violating both the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, and the Federal National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. Wheeler explains how Caltrans allegedly violated these acts, as well as potential silver linings to this legal battle loss.
So both CEQA and NEPA require that government agencies accurately tell the public about the likely environmental consequences of their proposed actions. So here, what Caltrans said was that there were going to be no significant impacts to old-growth redwoods. And to arrive at this conclusion, they relied on kind of anecdotal reports, largely from the 1960s after the construction of the highway through Humboldt Redwood State Park, to say that old-growth trees are resilient and they are unlikely to be impacted by the agency cutting into and paving over their roots. We thought that their analysis was flawed. In part, they hired an arborist to find that exact conclusion. The arborist employed methods that were not scientifically backed to arrive at the conclusion and kind of created his own methodology that arrived at the conclusion that the agency wanted. And so for very many years, we were arguing that the agency didn't complete a meaningful or truthful investigation of the likely environmental impacts, but rather they hired someone to create a report to tell them what they wanted to hear. And we believe that this is the case because Caltrans, I think, fundamentally could not admit that they were going to impact old-growth redwoods. They would not have the social license to complete this project had they done so. And so the agency had to functionally arrive at the conclusion that was found in the project report, that the project was not going to have impacts. So therein is the violation of both NEPA and CEQA. And we, unfortunately, in federal court, had a bad draw of judges at the Ninth Circuit, including a number of Trump-appointed judges. And so we lost there. And now here, it appears that we're losing on a technicality in the California appellate court. So it's a disappointing ruling, and I grieve the injuries that are about to occur to old-growth redwoods in the state park. But I think that there might be some silver linings I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely, if you want to get into that.
So I think that this project has changed the way that Caltrans approaches controversial projects or projects that might impact natural resources. So the Richardson Grove project was done with very little public engagement, public participation. The project was kind of announced and Caltrans was moving forward with relatively skimpy environmental analysis. Because of the litigation, I think that we've seen a change in practice at Caltrans. So, for example, the Last Chance Grade project, years before the first environmental documents came out for that project, Caltrans was meeting with stakeholders, including EPIC, to try to avoid a similar outcome. And so the engagement by the agency has been far more robust in other projects since Richardson Grove. So I hope that there was something gained from all of this litigation, that the agency has kind of changed practices for the better, to better inform the public about what's going on, to do better environmental analysis, to try to reduce risks to rare and precious resources like old growth. So time will only tell, I suppose, the lasting effect of this, but I hope that the example set in Last Chance Grade, which came after Richardson Grove, is a lasting one.
The court ruling was final, with Judge P.J. Stewart stating in the appellate court's decision, quote, CEQA litigation sometimes threatens to become a never-ending battle over certification of an environmental impact report that can drag on for years, even decades. This CEQA battle has come to an end.
This has been a fight for over a decade, and we've been supported by folks in the community tremendously. So I want to thank everybody who has been part of the Save Richardson Grove Coalition. For my co-plaintiffs, which include sister environmental organizations like the Center for Biological Diversity and Friends of Del Norte County, to individuals like Tricia Lotus, Barbara Kennedy. There have been so many friends in this fight, and I appreciate everyone for sticking by EPIC and sticking by Richardson Grove over the last decade and a half.
According to the press release from Caltrans, project construction is currently anticipated to begin depending on favorable weather conditions in either late May or early July. This is Nat Cardos for KMUD News.
Humboldt native Ori Stetzel is set to perform violin in the play Shades and Shadows at the Magic Theater in San Francisco from April 30th to May 3rd. She will be performing the violin on stage with the actors in the show. KMUD talked with Stetzel about her upcoming performance, her relationship to the arts, and her background growing up in Humboldt County. Stetzel works in costume design and sustainable clothing design, but music has been a part of her life since she was a kid. But this is the first time in a long time that she has performed professionally. Stetzel shared that she was offered this after working with the director on a different project.
I met Cece, the director, on a different project that we were both working on through UC Berkeley, the Eco Performance Lab, and kind of just organically came to myself offering up my violin abilities for this big Eco Performance Lab project. And then she, you know, via finding that out, was really excited and asked if I wanted to work on this project. So it kind of just all happened very organically.
Growing up, Stetzel started playing violin while attending the Coastal Grove Charter School in Arcata.
I started playing in, I think, fourth grade. It was a requirement for my school growing up. Everyone had to choose an instrument. It was Coastal Grove Charter School. And pretty soon in middle school, I joined the youth orchestra that I assume they probably still meet and perform up at HSU. It's been a while. And then went into the RMAC orchestra when I was at Arcata High and stayed in orchestra through most of my undergrad at Santa Monica College and then San Francisco State University. And then after that, it's kind of just been on my own time, incorporating violin and vocals a little bit here and there and making music by myself and with my partner. And now this.
Growing up, Stetzel built her community around music, learning from Carol Jacobson, the current conductor and artistic director for the Eureka Symphony.
I feel like how some people grow up with sports and they have that kind of community that they form with those friends from their early childhood on. That's what happened with me and music and violin. Like everyone around me, we were all learning violin together, going to orchestra together, and kind of forming that community. And then one person that was, I think, to this day, I think she was like the most impactful, awesome music instructor was Carol Jacobson, who I'm not sure if she's still directing the Armac Orchestra for Arcata High and McKinleyville High, but I know that she was also the director for the Eureka Symphony, I'm pretty sure. And she was also the choir director. She helped me and a lot of other students that couldn't really afford big trip be able to also go on the big music trips that the students would go on for the, you know, high school trips to Europe and such. And she found ways always of connecting music to various cultural points that were just really, really, I don't know, kind of magical. Like, for instance, one of the things that she had us do every year was a silent film performance. So the whole orchestra of about 80 to 90 people would put together a film score from all old music that used to be used in silent films in the like the 20s and 30s. And then we would learn it and rehearse it with an actual silent film and then perform it for a couple weekends. That's always one that I remember as being really a really cool experience that I don't know that many people get to experience that.
Stetzel also mentioned that growing up, she would listen to K-Mud shows with her mother, even listening to tapes her mother recorded of different reggae radio shows through the years.
When I was a little kid, throughout most of my child or a lot of my childhood, my mom and I, we always listened to, well, lots of different shows on K-Mud, and she always used to record the Rankin Reggae Rotation on tape. And we have all of these tapes that she recorded over the years that are, you know, various different reggae radio shows that have become almost like albums to us that we have listened to over the years. And I don't know, it just always had a very special place for me in my early musical development.
The Eureka Police Department is seeking information on a residential burglary. Rachel Solemn, the Eureka Police Department's operational analyst, reads the press release.
On April 1st, 2026, officers with the Eureka Police Department responded to a residence at the 3500 block of M Street for a report of a burglary. Upon arrival, officers met with the victim, who reported that an unknown suspect gained access to the residence and stole a large amount of jewelry. Video surveillance indicates the incident occurred on March 31st, 2026, between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. The suspect was observed wearing an orange facial covering at the time of the incident. This case remains an open and active investigation, and the EPD is requesting anyone with information related to this incident contact the Criminal Investigations Unit at 707-441-4300.
The Bayshore Mall has gone up for sale. According to a report from the Humboldt Times-Standard, the mall is currently $39 million in debt and is heading for a trustee sale at the Humboldt County Courthouse on April 17th. Bayshore Mall is currently leased and managed by the Spinoso Real Estate Group, which is based in New York State. The group has come under controversy in recent years, including two lawsuits filed by the African American and Iranian store owners in the Midwest alleging racial discrimination. The Bayshore Mall is currently the only indoor shopping center within a 155-mile radius of Eureka. Future owners may choose to redevelop the Bayshore site as its largest tenant, Walmart, purchased the vacant former Kmart at 4325 Broadway in Eureka last year. In national news, Trump speech, oil, and stock market response. Last night, President Trump addressed the nation during a 19-minute primetime address on the Iran war. The president claimed during the address that military action in Iran is near an end.
We are systematically dismantling the regime's ability to threaten America or project power outside of their borders. That means eliminating Iran's navy, which is now absolutely destroyed, hurting their air force and their missile program at levels never seen before, and annihilating their defense industrial base. We've done all of it. Their navy is gone. Their air force is gone. their missiles are just about used up or beaten. Taken together, these actions will cripple Iran military, crush their ability to support terrorist proxies, and deny them the ability to build a nuclear bomb. Our armed forces have been extraordinary. There's never been anything like it militarily. Everyone is talking about it, and tonight I'm pleased to say that these core strategic objectives are nearing completion.
Trump also brought up oil prices and the stock market repeatedly during his remarks.
Many Americans have been concerned to see the recent rise in gasoline prices here at home. This short-term increase has been entirely the result of the Iranian regime launching deranged terror attacks against commercial oil tankers in neighboring countries that have nothing to do with the conflict. We were a dead and crippled country after the last administration and made it the hottest country anywhere in the world by far with no inflation.
Despite the president's claims, stock markets are sharply lower than their record highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed Thursday at 46,504, which is over 3,600 points lower than its all-time high of 50,121, set on February 11th of this year. Trump seemed to contradict himself later in the speech, when he continued speaking about oil pricing, domestic oil production, and the possibility of attaining oil from Venezuela.
Remember, because of our drill baby drill program, America has plenty of gas. We have so much gas. Under my leadership, we are number one producer of oil and gas on the planet without even discussing the millions of barrels that we're getting from Venezuela. Because of the Trump administration's policies, we produce more oil and gas than Saudi Arabia and Russia combined. Think of that, Saudi Arabia and Russia combined. And that number will soon be substantially higher than that. There's no country like us anywhere in the world, and we're in great shape for the future. The United States imports almost no oil through the Hormuz Strait and won't be taking any in the future. We don't need it.
Crude oil, passing through the Strait of Hormuz, accounts for approximately 11% of usual U.S. petroleum imports, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It's also important to note that traffic through the strait accounts for approximately 20% of all worldwide petroleum consumption and has a direct connection to U.S. pricing. Fuel costs, as a result of the Iran war and the Hormuz crisis, remain high across the nation and Humboldt County. Pricing at the Chevron in Redway ranges from $6.45 for regular gas to $7.85 for diesel fuel. Prices are likely to continue rising as Brent crude oil pricing is up 43% over the past month and now sits at $109 per barrel. In other administration news, Pam Bondi has been relieved of her duties as Attorney General. According to NBC News, sources said that President Trump and Bondi had been involved in a heated altercation last week. Bondi's tenure was controversial, including failed investigations against Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, New York Attorney General Letitia James, and six members of Congress, who made a video telling American soldiers to disobey unlawful orders. In a post on Truth Social, Trump named Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche as Bondi's acting replacement. In National Native News, Jill Freitas reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Over the weekend, a Diné Pro athlete from the Arizona Ridge Riders ascended to the top ranks of competitive bull riding worldwide. KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio has more.
Keyshawn just crafted his career moment, and he perches above them all and is the master of the pit.
For the first time, Keyshawn Whitehorse won the Ty Murray Invitational after hanging on to a bucking bull named Lights Out. The 28-year-old had a perfect record, going 4-for-4 on his rides, and pretty much everybody in the building was right behind him.
Navajo Nation, the support here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I've dreamed of this moment in my entire life, and now we're on track for a gold buckle. This is a great stepping stone.
Whitehorse is now among the top 10 riders in the world. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Alaska Native groups have scrambled to make their voices heard on a series of subsistence proposals from Safari Club International, which aims to reshape fish and game management on federal lands. By the time the deadline for public comment passed on Monday, more than 2,000 people had weighed in. Rhonda McBride from our flagship station in Anchorage reports.
The letters are emotional, overwhelmingly, from rural hunters and fishers worried that the Safari Club's proposals to the U.S. Interior Department threaten their ability to live off the land. Tribal leaders like Gayla Hossett say these battles never seem to end.
We're oftentimes repeating ourselves over and over.
This time, Native groups are facing off against one of the most powerful sport hunting advocacy groups in the nation, which seeks to overturn Biden administration policies that added three tribally nominated seats to the Federal Subsistence Board. The Safari Club also wants to remove three other public seats and return the board to its original makeup, limited to the heads of five federal agencies.
It's a revolving door of these regional administrators that come through our state and that are here for a time, and they're making management decisions, not really knowing being on the land.
As a senior advisor to Interior Secretary Deb Haaland during the Biden administration, Raina Thiel shepherded the process of adding the additional tribal seats. Although it took about 3.5 years to get them in place, Thiel says it was worth the effort. Along the way, tribal leaders introduced many ideas on how to improve subsistence management on federal lands.
Nobody really lives the way we live in Alaska. It's an incredibly unique system. And so folks just don't have the context or the history with it to really understand it.
The Safari Club has also called on federal managers to defer to the state when overseeing wildlife on federal land. But opponents say that conflicts with a 1980 law which gives rural Alaskans priority for hunting and fishing on federal lands.
The word deference means consideration. It's not a mandate.
John Sturgeon, a longtime Alaska Safari Club policymaker, says the group does not oppose rural priority.
We're not asking for that. We're saying that they have to listen to fish and game, and we don't think they've been doing that over the years.
Alaska's dual management system for state and federal lands has spawned many a battle over the right to hunt and fish, and this one could be the start of another long fight. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Matt Cardos and Jill Freitas. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.